ideas seem to come out of nowhere, write about songs the way some people write about people. The thinking was that there would be great stories behind some of our iconic songs, just as there are great stories behind interesting people. Writer Mark Myers, a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal, got the assignment to write about those songs, and that's led to his Anatomy of a Song column in the paper, and a new book, Anatomy of a Song, the oral history of 45 iconic hits that changed rock, R&B, and pop. Mark is also the man behind the JazzWax.com music blog. And folks, check it out because it's become a must-read for me every day. This is Mark's second visit to Up to Date. And Mark, what a pleasure to have you again. Welcome.
Steve, thank you so much for having me.
Where does your love of music come from, Mark?
I guess isolation. When I was a kid, my folks moved out of the city north of New York to middle of Westchester County, northern Westchester County, and I just didn't fit in. So music became, I guess, my best friend.
Did you ever think it would lead you to conversations with folks like Mick Jagger and Debbie Harry and Merle Haggard?
Never in my wildest dreams, but to be honest, I'm waiting my whole life to do this.
Tell us the story of the phone call that got you started on the Anatomy of a Song column, because this came right out of the blue.
I was having lunch in New York, actually with my wife, and I got a text from the Wall Street Journal, and they wanted to try something new. They wanted to try what they were calling Anatomy of a Song, which was, let's focus on one song, let's talk to the songwriter and just do a whole number on that one particular song. And I said, well, which song do you want to start with? And I got back, why don't we start with My Girl by Smokey Robinson?
Hmm.
Initially, they were looking for a write-through, which in the business means you write the story and add some quotes from, in this case, Smokey Robinson. And we did that, and I did that, and that worked out fine. And then the second one we did sort of the same way. But by the third one, I started to realize that it wasn't fitting in its natural groove, that for this column to really take off as a narrative, it needed to be an oral history. The reader needed to read the words of the artist directly, not through what I was interpreting.
I'm wondering, did you pick the songs in the book because, you know, the songs were significant themselves, or because the song had a great backstory behind it?
No, the songs I chose because, number one, they were personal. I grew up with them. These songs, I guess, Steve, are what I would call the cool cousins of the mainstream songs. They're not the interstate highway hits that you would expect from these artists. Mm-hmm. They're a bit off the beaten path. So, you know, with Mick Jagger, not Jumpin' Jack Flash, but Moonlight Mile, mm-hmm. right? Not Born to Be Wild by Steppenwolf, but Magic Carpet Ride. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're sort of off the beaten trail a little bit, and that garnered a great story.
You know, you've talked to Jagger and Joni Mitchell and so many of the other great songwriters. I'm wondering how articulate they are about the process of writing these songs, because oftentimes the process is so personal, and it strikes me as often so elusive as well.
Their enthusiasm is fascinating, because once they realized I was there for the art, they in turn delivered poetry. And what they talked about, it was as if they were talking about their favorite child. It wasn't even as if they were talking about a song anymore. It was deeply personal, and they were showing off their favorite kid.
You know, it struck me, too, just spinning through the book, that there's so much luck involved in this songwriting process. You know, someone remembers a song that was written years ago. It didn't go very far. And suddenly they revisit it and turn it into this smash number one sensation. How much luck is involved here?
Not so much luck, because the talent is there.
Of course.
And then you've got great producers in the studio very often who have visions for what they want to do, and they have an understanding of what a hit will be. So that's a big help. But I think if there's a common thread in some of these songs, it's the pressure of deadline. A lot of these songs were written at the last minute, or because the original version didn't work out and they didn't have much time left and they had to figure out a better way to do it. And, you know, whether it's Walk This Way, where they, you know, go down to Times Square to see Young Frankenstein come back and love that line, Walk This Way, and that becomes the title of the song, or Time After Time, which Cyndi Lauper found in a TV guide in the studio with not much time to go to get that song done.
She found what in a TV guide? The words?
The title. Time After Time. They were stuck. When she went into the studio with Rob Hyman, her co-writer, they wanted to start with titles, because most artists do. They start with a title, and that sort of gets them juice to create the lyrics. And when they're in there, they can't quite come up with a title that they both like. It's just not happening. And Cindy picks up a TV guide, and she starts looking through the titles and finds a science fiction film from 1979. And, you know, she decides, let's start with this title. This sounds like it's going to be fine. But she never expected it to be the title of the song. It was just a starting point. Funny, huh?
How big of a hit was this for her?
Oh, it was huge. I mean, this was a major hit. This went to number 4, I believe. And it was just, I mean, it identified her. It still identifies her. It's sort of this sad, happy ballad of leaving, whether it's a lover or a town, a small town. And the video, of course, Steve, really kicked in the visual.
You know, this is apropos of nothing, but a few months ago, you put up a link to Miles Davis's one of his versions of that song, which just absolutely stopped me. This song that we're listening to right now, it just stopped me. Just absolutely incredible. I'd never heard it before.
Wasn't that something?
Yeah.
And, you know, we can thank Cicely Tyson, Miles Davis's wife at the time, for that.
That's right.
The album. She's so unusual and insisted he listen to it. And she insisted he listen to Time After Time, and he recorded it.
How about a different song here, Mark? The Rolling Stones and Street Fighting Man. You say the sound of French police car sirens got the Stones and Mick Jagger thinking in a different way about this song.
When we were talking, I asked what was the big influence on the melody, and he laughed and he said French police sirens, which of course, as anybody knows, goes
Yeah, right.
And if you listen to the song, you hear that very reference in the middle of the song.
That's really and what else did they say about this particular song and how they put it together?
What most people don't know about this song, which blew my mind when Keith told me, is that it's all acoustic except for the electric bass. In other words, Keith is basically putting down that power chord in the beginning on his knees, and he's putting it into a very small early cassette recorder. He couldn't use an electric guitar because it overwhelmed the tiny little mic, so he used the acoustic guitar. And Charlie Watts is playing this 1930s little drum kit that drummers would take on the train and put on their lap to practice. And there he is, you know, it's all acoustic. And then Keith stood up and played the electric bass because Bill Wyman wasn't there. And that's the only electric instrument on here is the electric bass. But if you listen to this song, you'll hear exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, was it harder to make great songs years ago, Mark, before all this high-tech equipment came along? Because, again, I don't know anything about this stuff, but I would guess that the answer to that is yes.
Songwriting, Steve, used to be like building furniture. There was one person who wrote the song, words and music, or it was two people. It's not better or worse today. It's just different because things have changed. Technology has changed. The listener's ears have changed. Even music has changed. So if you go to the Billboard Top 10, for example, and start to look at the credits, you notice there's like 8-9 people on each of the songs for the top 10. And that has a variety of, you know, reasons for that. But when I was a kid, you know, you'd look at the album and stare at the speakers and listen.
Yeah.
And today, it's mostly background. Kids have it, you know, behind them while they work on their computers or at the gym.
We used to sit and look at the album over it for hours, trying to glean some sort of meaning out of the damn thing that may or may not was ever there to begin with, you know?
Yeah, the cover, the notes, who produced it. It's funny, right?
You talk about some of the other tricks that were used in some of these songs, Mark. How about The Doors and Light My Fire? What did they do with that song to make it what it was?
First of all, you know, why that song is infectious to begin with, it's sort of catchy and you kind of love the main theme area of it. And I asked the drummer, John Densmore, why is it so addictive? And I said, there's almost like a Latin beat in there.
Yes.
And John said, you know, true confession, I was actually a fan of Girl from Ipanema. I loved Stan Getz and Astrid Gilberto's hit in 1964, and I used a bossa nova beat in there.
Now, that is so interesting because you do hear that. It's got that easygoing something behind it, despite the Morrison vocal, which is so obviously powerful, you know, but there's that background thing that is a little bit easier, isn't it?
Yeah, he's using his stick, and he's got it laying on the snare, and he's striking it against the rim, almost like a lounge bossa nova player.
Let's listen to a little bit of The Doors and Light My Fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. Yeah. know, you say, Mark, that you don't know if a song is going to turn out to be iconic for as long as 25 years after it was released. Why so many years? I mean, why can't we know right away?
You know, to me, when I was putting this together, I said, I really owe the reader an explanation of what the word iconic means, how I'm defining it.
Yeah.
And iconic means over time. So is that 20 minutes? Is it 2 years? Is it 6 years? And what I figured is it really needs a generation. It needed 25 years, which is why I stopped in 1991 with REM's Losing My Religion, because it needs 25 years to burn off the fad, burn off the trends, burn off the times in which it was recorded. I mean, if we go back 25 years and we say, oh, at the time, you know, let's say the early 80s, whatever 25 years is, but if we insist that, you know, culture clubs, you know, one of Culture Club's hits is the absolute be-all, end-all, and it's going to be the greatest song ever recorded. We might feel that way at the time because it seems like that. But 25 years later, it's a good song. Is it iconic? Probably not.
That's interesting. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're visiting with Mark Myers, his new book, Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. What is it about some of the songs that causes them to hang around? After you've spent so much time studying them for your book, have you come to a conclusion here?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, Steve. I'm extremely passionate about this music, and I look at it as art. For a song to be iconic for me, there's an invisible frequency, right? If it's a great song and it really stands the test of time and still moves people today, there's this invisible beam that runs between the artist's heart and the listener.
Oh,
and it doesn't matter the age, but there's a connection, there's a bond. So if you hear Magic Carpet Ride today, or you hear Groovin', if you just put on Groovin' for a kid today, that kid's going to hear the Young Rascals' emotion. They're going to hear, you know, Felix Cavalieri's feelings about the woman he was writing about. They hear it invisibly, and they respond to it. That, to me, is an iconic song.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, another thing I was wondering here, you talk to these artists about topics they've been asked about over and over and over again. How'd you get the interviews to begin with?
Well, some of these interviews were done on the phone. Some of them were done in person. I need to do two things, Steve. I need to do up to 6-7 hours of research because I need to know more about this music than they do. I need to know the full anatomy of these songs. And then what I need to do is I need to push the town limit, the city limits, beyond what everybody already knows. So once I know everything that's been written about these songs, I then owe it to the reader to go beyond that and provide little bits of detail and insights that haven't really been captured yet.
And I bet the folks you're interviewing recognize that and appreciate it pretty quickly, Mark.
Well, that's what's interesting. For instance, on Moonlight Mile, I got a great story on loneliness out of Mick Jagger.
I wanted to ask you about that because that story in the book is so interesting to me.
It's harrowing, right? I mean, I felt as though I was sitting with him next to him on that train, feeling that depression. And I had 20 minutes with Mick Jagger, 21, 22 minutes. That was it. So to answer your question, they need to be able to feel my passion, because in order for me to get a great story out of them, I need to talk in their language, which is the passion and the art and the poetry of their music. Once they understand I'm not there for scandal and I'm not there for tabloid dirt, they then treat me like a serious investigator, and they are much more open very, very quickly, because speed is of the essence. I need to get that story as fast as possible, but I can't rush it to the point where they realize or think that I'm putting time and my interests above what they're trying to tell me.
Oh, that's interesting. I was so interested in Jagger's story about what spurred him to write Moonlight Mile. Tell us about that.
You know, when we did Moonlight Mile, it's a curious song. You don't quite know where it's coming from and why it's even on Sticky Fingers. But when Mick starts talking about it, the loneliness of touring in 1972, you know, you have to keep in mind there's no real security back then. There's no staging. There's no protection against fans throwing things. And they're feeling a great deal of hostility when they're traveling on the European continent in 72, I think it is. And they're alone all the time. They have to travel a lot of times by night on trains because they can't get hotels, or the management is too cheap, or they don't have the money. So he's just staring out the window at midnight. He's watching the moon play off the countryside as this train is whizzing through the dark, heading to the next concert engagement. But talking to him about it, I could really feel the depths of his loneliness. Mm-hmm. And what I do in these songs, as you know, is I try to capture the artist's voice. The biggest compliment I can get is the reader telling me, I felt like Mick was talking to me. I didn't even feel that you were there. I felt we were having that conversation.
That's great. You know, if you go to jazzwax.com, along the right-hand side, there's a rail of all the musicians and other folks, for that matter, that you've interviewed. Here's a question for you. If you could invite four musicians that you've interviewed over the years to dinner, they could be living or dead, who would you want to sit down with again and spend an evening with, Mark?
Wow, that's a toughie.
Yeah, I figured it might be.
You know, Sonny Rollins. I mean, Sonny Rollins is so mystical. I mean, he's so fascinating. He's had so much history. He is the history of individualism. I mean, when you think about jazz and personal expression and changing how the tenor saxophone's personality sounds, it's Sonny Rollins, right, in the early 1950s. I would probably want to have Jerry Lee Lewis there. I would probably want to have Keith Richards there.
Yeah.
And I would probably want to have Joni Mitchell there.
sounds pretty good. Listen, if you can arrange it, invite me and I'll bring the Joe's Barbecue, okay?
Arthur Bryant's.
I'm flexible. I can go there too. Let's do this, Mark. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with Mark Myers. We're going to turn to some other iconic songs like Kansas City, Proud Mary, and Heart of Glass, and run through some different versions of the different tracks and talk about them, and Mark will break them down for us. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, the film critics recommended their favorite flicks now on area screens. Hear that conversation at kcur.org/up to date and on the NPR One app. We're taking off to celebrate the 4th, but tune in for a holiday edition of Innovation Hub that explores how our geography shapes who we are, questions some long-held assumptions about our democracy, and looks for the American dream in Canada. We're visiting this hour with Mark Myers. He's a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal. His new book, Anatomy of a Song, The Oral Histories of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. And Mark, let's turn to some of these iconic songs that you talk, three of them that you talk about in the book. And one that means a whole lot to this town is the song Kansas City. I didn't realize that it was originally titled KC Loving. Why was it called that?
This is 1952. Mike Stoller and Jerry Lieber are both in Los Angeles, and they begin to see that they can get a lot of work helping produce and write songs for these artists and this R&B industry that's rising up. And they create this song that they call Kansas City, but when they take it into Federal Records, the head of Federal says, Kansas City, that's square, man. He says, you know, this has to be hip. Let's call it KC Loving. And it got changed that way, much to Mike's chagrin. Mike was not happy about that change, but they were too young to really make a fuss. They had no real power to do it. And of course, the song never even charts. So maybe too hip by half.
I was going to say the song doesn't chart. It fades away pretty quickly. But then a few years later, it's revived. How did that happen?
Wilbert Harrison had heard Little Willie's version for years, and he gave it his own feel, which has a different sound. It's not as bluesy, and it's more of a stroll. And, you know, the stroll was popular then, the dance, and people started to really feel what he was doing with it. And it was the right song at the right time. And as Mike said, you know, KC Loving fell off the charts, but then we had a hit with it 7 years later.
You know, he changed a key line in the song, which you point out in the book, from they've got a crazy way of loving there and I'm going to get me some, to they got some crazy little women there and I'm going to get me one. That was a change that people here appreciate a whole lot, Mark, because it's a line that everyone knows.
Yeah, I think it was a little too risque originally. It was for a little bit of a different market. And I think, you know, instead of making it somebody going off to Kansas City for a variety of things, they narrowed it to one thing.
One more thing about this song that so interested me. A whole batch of singles of this song were issued one after another in 1959. Hank Ballard, Little Richard. Why did that happen?
Because Wilbert Harrison had a monster hit with this thing. It was number one. And when something's number one, every producer wants a version of it. Little Richards, of course, he sort of stuck to the original a little bit, but then he recorded the entire second side as Hey, Hey, Hey. He completely changed it, which you're never supposed to change the lyrics of an original song. You can interpret it, but to change the lyrics, you know, creates a major legal problem. But for Lieber and Stoller, as Mike told me, Little Richard's the father of rock and roll. You know, what are you going to do? So they let him share on his version in the royalties because of, you know, who he was and what he was bringing to that song. And, of course, the Beatles pick it up. They do Little Richard's version, and they don't even realize that it's Lieber and Stoller. Lieber and Stoller have to go around correcting everybody and making it clear that this didn't come out of thin air. It came from them.
Well, let's listen to the original version by Wilbert Harrison, then we'll listen to some other tracks as well.
Well, I might take the train, I might take the plane, but if I have to walk, I'm going just the same. Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come. They got some crazy little women there, and I'm gonna get me one. Ah, but you know, yeah, myself.
Okay, let's do this now, Mark, if we can. Let's go back and listen to what the Beatles did to this song. This was 5 years later in 1964. This is the Beatles playing their version of Kansas City. Is that Paul singing the lead there?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And you say they had no idea what the history of the song or really what it represented.
Right. I mean, Paul is basically lifting Little Richard's version.
Let's go to Little Richard's version and take a listen to this one then. Little Richards, he's messing with this song a little bit, isn't he?
He's messing with it quite a bit. He's bringing soul to it, and he's bringing a very heavy R&B feel, New Orleans style.
Yeah, okay. Let's go to one more version here, or maybe a couple more. This is Hank Ballard's version, another one that came out in 1959.
I'm gonna be standing on the corner, corner, 12th and Vine.
There's nothing about 12th Street and Vine that really resembles anything the way it was back in the day any longer, but interesting.
And
anything
Hank
about
Ballard
Hank?
Version,
yeah.
Yeah, the Hank Ballard version is almost two ticks too slow, right?
Yes.
You kind of want it to be a little more, you want a little more pickup there, but it feels as though it's almost lumbering.
But the point is that song was flexible. People could do a lot
yeah,
of
exactly.
things with it. Well, let's go to Proud Mary that John Fogerty wrote for Creedence Clearwater Revival. I love how these songs get started because Fogerty told you that he kept a small notebook and kept a list of song title ideas in it. His first entry that he had ever wrote down was Proud Mary, and he didn't even know what those words meant. He just liked how they sounded together. It's a pretty interesting story, Mark.
There's no context to that at all. He just liked the way they sounded, just as you said, Steve. He's waiting for his Army discharge papers. He's in the Army Reserve. In 1967, he gets them in the mail. When he goes down to the mailbox, he flips out. He does a handstand outside, jumps up, runs upstairs to his apartment, grabs his Rickenbacker guitar, and starts fooling around with something he had been playing with for an introduction. He was playing around with Beethoven's Fifth, the opening, dun 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 dun,
yeah,
and
yeah.
He doesn't quite like what Beethoven did with it. doesn't really care for it. And instead of putting the emphasis on the fourth, dun-dun-dun-dun, he puts the emphasis on the first chord. Dun-dun-dun-dun, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. I mean, you can hear that intro. It's Beethoven's fifth with the emphasis on the first chord, not the fourth.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of the Creedence Clearwater Revival version of Proud Mary. Here we go. You know, the original Proud Mary that we're listening to here was almost solely a John Fogerty creation, you write, but the band had a huge fight over it. What happened there?
For whatever reason, John Fogerty wanted the vocals to be a certain way, the background vocals, and what he got, for some reason, was a sort of a garagey sound. It wasn't as clean as he wanted it. He wanted something very specific. So when they all went off to dinner, John went back to the studio and he overdubbed the vocals. He did all the vocal background vocals in harmony by overdubbing his own voice, and they had a fit. I mean, they just really had a fit about it.
And the band almost broke up over it, right?
They did. But as soon as he said, "Calm down, let me play it back for you." And when he played it back, everything was quiet, and then one of the musicians said, "Oh, wow."
That works.
Yeah.
That's the genius of John Fogerty then.
Oh, unbelievable. He is so amazingly talented.
He had never even seen the Mississippi River when he wrote that song, but before the song came out, he made a point of going to see it, right? What did he do?
He saw a movie in which two riverboats race, and this notion that a riverboat had a personality, that Proud Mary could feel something and express something and have a personality and have a point of view in the river as it travels and trudges up the river. That's what he was aiming for. But of course, what's fascinating is he goes down, you know, to Memphis at one point, and little kids take him to see a riverboat that's dry docked, and he looked at the boat and he said, "That's exactly how I envisioned Proud Mary."
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, isn't that poetic?
That's great. That's just let's listen to three other versions of Proud Mary. The first one is from Solomon Burke. What should we know about this one, Mark?
This is really important because you can't understand Ike and Tina Turner's version unless you listen to Solomon Burke's version and you listen to the Checkmates Limited. Now, on Solomon Burke, listen to what he does in the beginning part. It's narration. He's not singing but telling you a story. Go ahead.
I know a lot of you folks would like to know what the old Proud Mary is all about. Well, I'd like to tell you about her. She's nothing but a big old boat. You see, my forefathers used to ride the bottoms of her as stokers, cooks, and waiters. And I made a vow that when I grew up, I'd take a ride on the old Proud Mary. And if you'd let me, I'd like to sing about it. Looking for a job in the city, working for the man every night and day, and I never lost a minute of speed, worrying about the way things might have been. Big wheels keep on turning, Proud Mary keep on burning. Y'all just rolling, rolling, rolling on the river.
He's just talking about Proud Mary and why it's a special, you know, he talks through, there's a good minute, 30-second narration by Solomon Burke there. And the song only goes to number 45.
Now we have the version from Sonny Charles, also from 1969. What about this one?
This is the Checkmates Limited, and now you're going to hear an extremely upbeat, raucous version of this song.
Yeah.
Okay, and now those two versions give birth to something that Ike and Tina Turner did in 1970, just a year later. And this is a version that a lot of folks are still going to remember.
Steve, they basically take the two versions and put them together like a sandwich.
Here we go. Let's listen to Ike and Tina Turner. This is their version of Proud Mary. You know, Mark, you couldn't play that song any faster and get away with it, I think.
Exactly right. And that song goes to number four. And that's a huge hit in 1971. They basically took the narration, you know, what she says, we're going to start nice and easy, but we never do anything easy. We're going to do it nice and rough. That's always her starter on that. And that's what they did. They sandwiched it.
All right. If you're just joining us again, you're listening to Up to Date. We're having a great time with writer Mark Myers from the Wall Street Journal, going through his book, Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. Let's go now to Heart of Glass, a completely different type of song that Blondie made famous. It was released back in 1979. This was a mashup of punk and disco, as you write. And this song is something of a miracle that it was ever created. It sits around for years, and then it gets a magical rebirth. What happened to Heart of Glass, Mark?
Well, in 74, Chris Stein of Blondie's on his couch fooling around, and he just loves Rock the Boat by the Hughes Corporation, the disco song. And he's fooling around with it, and, you know, he's overdubbing and doing some stuff with his little home studio. And he comes up with something, and Debbie Harry adds some lyrics to it. And they play it at clubs like Max's Kansas City and CBGB, and the fans like it, you know, and they call it the disco song. That's what they, you know, play the disco song. So they play it in the clubs. And finally, Blondie, they call it Once I Had a Love, and they kind of just shelve it away. And by 1978, their label, they want a hit album. It's time. Either it's make or break time. They're either going to have a hit, or they got to get rid of Blondie. So the label hires Michael Chapman, the English producer, to work this thing out. And Chapman asks Debbie Harry, says, who's your favorite singer? And Debbie says, Donna Summer. And Chapman says, whoa, I didn't even hear that coming. And he creates this whole Giorgio Moroder Euro disco Kraftwerk sound behind them in the analog age, before the digital age. And if you listen to Debbie Harry on this song, that's Donna Summer on I Feel Love.
Well, let's listen to Blondie's original version of this song, the disco song, and then we'll move on to Donna Summer's version and the hit that Blondie made famous here. Here's Blondie with the disco song from 1975. Okay, now let's move to the song that inspired Debbie Harry so much.
Just this, a quick jump in, Steve.
Yes,
that
please.
Was the reggae. That's the reggae demo.
Okay.
Which also had different lyrics, as you probably noticed.
Let's go to Donna Summer, the woman who inspired Deborah Harry so much. This is her version of I Feel Love from 1977. So Deborah Harry's listening to that thinking, this works for me, right?
She loves Donna Summer.
Okay. Well, let's go to the version then of Heart of Glass that became the big hit. This is Blondie performing Heart of Glass. It was released in 1979. No, it still sounds good. That phrase, heart of glass, where did that come from?
They came up with that because the original lyric, as you probably heard in the demo, was a little bit different and a little bit risque, and they didn't think that they would have a hit if they used the original lyric.
Let's go to one more song that a lot of folks love, Midnight Train to Georgia. Tell us about this song and how it came to be, Mark.
So in 1970, songwriter Jim Weatherly, he dials up his friend Lee Majors. He needs to talk to him about his flag football team. They were both flag football players. But Majors isn't home. His girlfriend, Farrah Fawcett, answers the phone, and she tells him, look, Lee is out, and I've got to catch a midnight plane to Houston. I got to go. So Weatherly hangs up. He goes, midnight plane to Houston. Midnight plane to Houston. That's pretty good. That's pretty good for a song. So he writes a song called Midnight Plane to Houston. He records it, and then his manager sends it out to higher-profile people who hopefully will cover it and make him lots of money. And, you know, Weatherly, the first person who picks it up is Sissy Houston. Sissy looks at the title, and she says, Midnight Plane to Houston. She says, my family comes from Georgia, and nobody down there flies on a plane. So she goes back to Weatherly and says, do you mind if I change the title to Midnight Train to Georgia? And he says, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Why not?
So she, yeah. And then Gladys covers it. Sissy, who doesn't have, it doesn't really chart. But Gladys picks it up. She wants to do it. And then, of course, she brings it.
Well, let's listen to the first track here, Jim Weatherly's original version, Plane to Houston.
And she's leaving.
Okay, now let's walk along the evolution of this song. This is Sissy Houston now. She's changed the words, as Mark just explained, to Train to Georgia. This is from 1972.
So he's fond of his hopes, and he even sold his old car. What a one-way ticket!
Now, let's go to Gladys Knight. She takes this song one step further, and this is the hit that
Boom.
Most people are going to recognize here.
I'm always leaving on that midnight train to Georgia. Yeah. Said he's going.
Well, that's about a clear of an evolution of a song as you're going to see, right?
Isn't that great?
That's just very, very interesting to see how that tracked along.
I'm sorry, Steve.
Well, I was going to say, I want to ask you, but in just a minute or so we have left here, about your blog again is jazzwax.com. Again, I'm a huge fan. How do you put that thing together each day, and where do you get your ideas for it? Because you're doing it 6 days a week, Mark.
A lot of times, Steve, it's what I was listening to that day while I was writing.
There you go.
So, you
know,
how do you
decide that?
Well, you know, it's mood. It's the weather. It's how cold it is or how warm it is. You know, sometimes if it's hot out, you know, a lot of times in the summer, I'll listen to the Beach Boys, a lot of pop. I'll listen to a lot of reggae. Sometimes, you know, in the wintertime, it'll be more jazz. So, you know, it's a mood thing. And then, like today, what I did is I created what I call a YouTube cocktail. I found drone footage of Vermont foliage, and I matched that. I muted that and then brought up the sound of Sarah Vaughan singing Moonlight in Vermont. So you can watch the drone footage and then listen to Sarah Vaughan. It's an interesting cocktail juxtaposition.
Again, I can't recommend to our listeners enough to check out jazzwax.com. And you also want to look at Mark Meyer's new book, Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. And Mark, next time you're in town, please call. I'd love to get together.
I love being with you today, Steve.
Mark, thanks so much. We said a year ago that we would not allow the story of our local Olympians to fade away, even though the next Summer Games aren't until 2020 in Tokyo. So how are they doing? Whose stock is up and whose stock is falling? Greg Eklund, a sports reporter for KCUR, is here. And Greg, always nice to have you.
Good to be here, Steve.
Let's start with Jack Sock, who won a gold medal in mixed doubles and a bronze medal in doubles last time.
He does very well in doubles. Some of his biggest professional moments in tennis have been in doubles. But this year, Steve, he has done very well in singles. And that's really where his emphasis is. He had a great start to the year. He won at Delray Beach in Florida. He won in New England. But lately, he has been struggling, and he's trying to resurrect himself, so to speak, because he has been struggling over the last month or so. He had an early round exit in the French Open. He also he had an early round exit also in Madrid, but reached, again, the doubles in semifinals in Madrid. So he has fared pretty well in doubles from time to time again this year and fared well early in the year in singles. He's just trying to come back, and Wimbledon is the place to do it.
I was going to say, what's the issue? Do you know?
I don't know.
But something's not right.
Something's not right, and it might be, you know, I would imagine that the confidence ebbs and flows with how the game is going. So I know he did take some time off leading into Wimbledon, probably get his head together before Wimbledon.
And Jack Sock is from one of the Blue Valley high schools, right?
He is. He is from Blue Valley North, I believe. And Jack Sock is the top-ranked American male. So he has had a rise in the world rankings after his two singles wins earlier this year. He got to as high as number 14 in the world. And so he is the top-ranked male American and really the best hope for America on the male side to go far in Wimbledon.
But in theory, America should have a singles player, what? I mean, given our size, and we should be in
absolutely.
Top five.
Or so. I mean, when you
this
think
is not
about,
a good time for American tennis, it doesn't sound like.
It's not. It's a time when you think about American tennis, you're thinking about the names like Andre Agassi and Pete Sampras, and nobody has risen to those levels yet, and America is waiting for somebody, and perhaps it's Jack Sock who could get to that level on the singles level.
Let's turn to a guy, Zach Garrett of Wellington, Missouri. He was an Olympic silver medalist in team archery.
Zach has not been in competition this year. He has decided to take some time off, he has, we've exchanged some messages. He has said that he is healthy. I would imagine because of all the preparation and everything that goes into preparing the Olympics that he probably just needed a break from the game and from the sport of archery. I do think that, although I do have a pending message to him, that he's probably going to return eventually with hopes of getting back to the Olympics in 2020. And while mentioning Zach, another Olympian from the Kansas City area, Lydia Patterson of Kansas City, Kansas, has also decided to take some time off. She was an Olympian in pistol shooting, and she has decided to concentrate a little more this year on her college education, and she's also a youth ambassador for USA Shooting and the NRA.
So a lot of athletes taking time off. That's a theme we're seeing here.
At least among those two, because there are others who are right back into it in competition, namely in track and field and in swimming, because both sports have world championships this year, and both this month have had national championships to get ready for the Worlds.
Let's talk about track and field because it has a lot of athletes connected to area colleges, and the USA Track and Field National Championships just took place as a qualifier for the August World Championships in London. Let's go there.
Sure. Starting out with UMKC alum Courtney Frericks. She's from Nixon, Missouri. She finished second in the 3,000-meter steeplechase at the National Championships. She was an Olympian last year in the same event. So she has qualified for the USA team that will be competing in the Worlds this year, which takes place in London in August. She lives and trains in Portland, Oregon, continues to be a world-class athlete.
How about discus thrower Mason Finley?
Oh, he's been an ascending athlete. Mason Finley thought he was going to retire after the Olympics last year. But after winning the discus at the Olympic trials last year and qualifying for the Olympics, he had a change of heart, and boy, it's a good decision for him because not only is he helping himself, he's getting a little help from the USA Track and Field Foundation because the foundation provides financial help for ascending elite athletes in their development, and Mason Finley is one of those recipients. He won the Nationals again this year, so he's back on the world team, and he'll be competing at the National Championships as well. And we did a story last year about his whole family that is involved with discus, and his younger sisters, Rebecca and Mattia, did very well at UMKC. Both made NCAA regional competition this season, so it still continues to run in the family.
Let's turn to Michael Stigler.
Yes. Michael Stigler, another KU athlete from 2012 to 2015. Unfortunately, Steve, he had to pull out of competing for the Olympic trials or for the Olympics at the trials last year. He had a hamstring, so he didn't even have a chance to compete in the trials, which was a big heartbreak for him. He finished second at the Nationals this year in the 400-meter hurdles. So this is a big deal for him because he didn't get to compete for the Olympics last year. He is on the USA World Team, or the USA team that will compete at the World Championships this year with hopes of still continuing his ascent toward 2020 in Tokyo.
We have a number of other athletes to mention here, but I'm wondering, is this sort of the most plentiful number of local Olympians you've seen in a while? Because this list is fairly impressive to me.
You know, through the local track and field programs we have here, I think it's very underrated and underpublicized on how well track and field at the colleges between KU, K-State, and at UMKC. I think all have done very well, and even in Missouri has sent some elite athletes to international competition. So I think on the local colleges have had a very positive effect with our local athletes.
Let's turn to a triple jumper. That's Andrea Gubel.
Yes. Another one who's just trying to break through. She made the Olympics last year through making a standard. She finished third at the trials, but through some competition that followed, she made the qualifying standard that made her an Olympian last year. The same thing happened again this year when she finished third, so she has a month now to reach the standard, and a standard which changes from year to year, and actually she has to make a personal record for herself in order to make the standard and qualify for this year's World Championships.
How do you keep track of all these people?
You've got to keep these lists going.
I was going to say, Eric Kennard, an Olympic silver medalist in the high jump last year. He finished third at the Nationals. Tell us about him.
He's an accomplished high jumper. He was a silver medalist in 2012 and was actually disappointed with his sixth place finish in the Olympics last year. But he, as you mentioned, he finished third at the Nationals, but he will be on the world team because he won what was referred to as the Diamond League. The Diamond League is a set of international track meets that are set up, and you accumulate points at these track meets. He happened to be the top point getter for the event of the high jump, so that put him on the world team for this year.
You know, swimming trials are going on this week for the World Championships to be held in Hungary this summer. Any local links there?
There are a few. Again, some underrated, underpublicized programs, particularly over in Columbia at Mizzou. Missouri will have Hannah Stevens and Michael Chadwick. They did very well at the trials, just were not able to make the Olympic team last year, so their stock is rising. Hannah Stevens won the national championship in the 50 back, and Chadwick has a tentative spot right now on the relay team because he finished fifth in the 100 free. I think we'll see more things, more big things from them. And Michael Andrew, that we talked about from Lawrence, he was homeschooled. It continues to be homeschooled. He didn't qualify for the world team, excuse me, but he has qualified for the World Junior Championships, which will be taking place in August in Indianapolis. He has qualified in three different individual events and the 4x100 relay. So he's at that age where, you know, he's in his late teens now, where he's ascending, and before long, he'll be making an impact on the world level and the big level.
That's Greg Eklund giving us an update, if you will, on local Olympians and where they're at. Greg, thanks very much.
You're
appreciate
welcome,
it.
Steve.
You can listen to previous programs and download our podcasts at kcur.org/uptodate. Follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. You can follow me at Steve Prasky. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. We're taking a break for the 4th of July, but tune in for a holiday edition of Innovation Hub. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell produce our program. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.